Accession number 4784, reel 3.
Reverend Sanbash, reel 3. Can we talk a little more about this inaugural meeting and elections? How was this meeting actually convened? Who took responsibility and initiative?
I think the true thing to say is that there was such restiveness in the camp, such disappointment, such anxiety, that from the various areas, which was our campus, and there was a fair distance between some of these places, people naturally somehow turned out and got together in one of the big open spaces, which fortunately was there. And then once we'd got there, one or two well-known people, I mean, we'd everybody in Hong Kong there, you see, high-ranking government servants, high-ranking business people, and one or two public people like myself, who was well-known as a broadcaster. That's how I really came into prominence. Many people knew me because of the broadcasting that I did. And
who were the other personalities amongst that group who took the initiative, do you remember?
There was a man named Larry Grayson, strangely enough, the same name as the Generation Game, who was a bit of a soldier of fortune, but a forceful character, whom I came to know very well. There were a number of ranking government servants, and then there were the heads of companies like Jardine's, Butterfield and Swire, Dodwell and Co., some of the big firms in Hong Kong. What they call their taipans, their bosses, they were there. And naturally, we were the ones who did some of the talking, and people were making suggestions, people were talking. And eventually we said, well, look, we'd better have a sort of show of hands and a rough and ready election and elect this temporary committee to try to get things working, to see where we can get to straighten out this mess. So can names be suggested? And certain number of names were suggested, and they indicated their willingness to become members of this committee. As I say, I was one of them. And eventually, when a sufficient number of names had been suggested to give the people a selection, then they were put up one by one. Who votes for so-and-so? And the votes were counted, and so it went on. And that's how the first committee was elected.
How large was it? How large was it?
We selected a dozen.
Do you remember who they were?
Now, just let me say this. As soon as the surrender took place, the governor himself, Sir Mark Young, was whisked away, and we never saw him again until after the war. The highest-ranking government servant then left was the colonial secretary, and unfortunately for him, he had only come to the colony 3 days before the Japanese attack started. He'd been in Ceylon all his life, and then had been promoted and got to Hong Kong as the colonial secretary just 3 days before the Japanese attack started. Imagine how he felt. But naturally, we said, well, he's got to be the chairman. He's the highest-ranking government officer. And then we elected a dozen people. As I say, the head of Jardine's, the head of Butterfield's, the head of Dodwell's, the head of Hutchinson Co., and then one or two other prominent people in the colony, of whom I was one, Reverend Cyril Brown, who was the chaplain of the Siemens Institute in Hong Kong, who was quite a personality and a wonderful man with music, concerts and all that sort of thing. He was well known in Hong Kong for this. This was the first committee. Now, the colonial secretary took the chair. He asked me to be his deputy, and as I say, I happen to be a survivor of all the elections which took place, so I remained as his deputy when he wasn't able to preside over the meetings. I presided over them, and at the end of it all, when government was resumed in Hong Kong, and I shall have something very important to say about that at the end of all this, the end of the story. When he and the government servants went out into Hong Kong, he left me in complete charge, and it fell to me to close the camp down and disperse it and close the gate. I was the last man out.
Just to finish with the subject of elections, were the procedures which you adopted rather spontaneously at that time, were they refined and developed in any way?
Yes. After that, our lawyers drew up conditions, you see, for elections, and nominations had to be made in writing. The elections were conducted as an election, say, for local councillors and that sort of thing, would be conducted here in England, with polling booths, with a secret vote, and properly supervised, properly counted, and then the announcements duly made as to who were elected and who weren't.
And how frequently did they take place there?
Well, in the early days, we had, say, in the first 18 months, after the first temporary, after 6 months, we elected again, because by that time people had settled down. After a year, we elected again. And after another 6 months, we elected again. By that time, the camp had sort of solidified and didn't want to be disturbed over much. And the Japanese weren't very happy about continuing with the elections, and it more or less remained as it was, say, at the end of 18 months. Mm.
The first Central Committee, having been elected, what immediate work did it carry out?
The first thing we did was to contact the Japanese authorities and impress upon them the very urgent necessity of organising daily rations into the camp, because people until then were carrying on with just what bits and pieces they had brought with them. Then we made the nominal roll, and that meant visiting every room so that we could find out who was in the camp, where they were, where they could be got at, what section of the camp they were in, what room they were in. And I think we were wise enough when we did that first survey to tell those who did it, I was one who did that, to keep an eye open for anything that we could see in the rooms or anywhere in the camp that would come in handy as the raw material that we knew we should have to find from somewhere to create the things that we knew we should need as time went on. And also our main idea was to use that nominal roll with a view to sorting the camp out and getting rid of the worst of the overcrowding, readjusting.
I see.
Actually, the situation was, as I've said, after a few reorganizations were done, the Japanese didn't want any more to do with that. Mm. They wanted the camp to remain as stable as it possibly could be.
Yes.
They didn't like altering their lists, their roles, and that sort of thing. In addition, it has to be said that it was impossible to do very much other than these few adjustments because the accommodation was not there. We were always going to be overcrowded, and we were overcrowded from beginning to end. There was no other answer.
What was the rationale of this organisation? What kind of criteria did you follow?
Perhaps I should go on now to say this. We had this Central Camp Council, which had the overall supervision of the camp and the governing of the camp. The camp naturally divided itself into three main areas. There was what was called the main blocks, and that's where the English, the European warders had lived. Flats were really quite... There was the Indian quarters, where the Indian warders had lived, and their quarters were not quite the same standard, but still quite good. And then there was the St. Stephen's complex, where the school had been. And we asked the residents of those areas to elect a local committee to do the sort of day-to-day jobs that were needed in each area. And the chairman and secretary, the chairman, vice chairman of each of those area committees, had a place on our camp committee. So that was the organisation of the camp, the central council, but with each of the three main areas having its own organisation for its day-to-day work, but with its representation on the central camp. Then we had seven different nationals in the camp. We had 300 Americans, we had 50-odd Dutch, we had about 40-odd Norwegians, we had a number of Belgians, one or two Poles and Greeks, and two poor folk who were stateless. But seven who needed recognition because of their countries of origin. We had the Americans with their representative on the camp, we had the Dutch with theirs, and the Norwegians with theirs, and we asked the rest to allow the Dutch and the Norwegians to represent them, because there were only a few of them, the Poles and the Greeks, on our central committee, and we got on very well. Now, you talked about repatriation. The Americans were repatriated just about 7 months after the camp started on an exchange basis. They were followed the following year by the Canadians, again on an exchange basis. And a strong rumour, of course, prison camps are great places for rumours. You live on them, and they help morale. And a strong rumour went round that all the British women and children were also going to be repatriated, and hopes ran high. In fact, one of our songwriters wrote a song which the ladies and children sang at the end of each of our concerts. We're going to sail away, sail away. What a happy day 'twill be when we're putting out to sea, afloat on the boat on the way to Lorenzo Marx. That was going to be the exchange basis. Never happened, unfortunately, and of course there was bitter disappointment. And after the departure of the Canadians, nobody sailed away anywhere. We were there to the bitter end.
Yes, that's very clear, but I would still like to know the criteria by which you allocated people to the various quarters that were available. I mean, did you do it on a sex basis, a seniority basis, a nationality basis?
There was no basis. As I've said, the camp remained more or less in the jammed-up position it was, irrespective of age, sex, relationship, or anything else, from the first day to the last. So everybody was everywhere with each other. There was no basis. It was just as the Japanese, the first people in, knew each other, because that's what they'd done, you see. But selfishly, trying to grab the best they could and keep it and keep others out was their own undoing, because they found shoved into them people they'd never known before. And it stayed like that. And that was one of the big problems that we had to solve and get a sort of community spirit growing and developing, with a sort of beginning like that, mm-hmm. which was disastrous. But it's surprising how actually some of the people who had the worst quarrels with themselves were those who went in as friends. I know, because I was usually the peacemaker.
Apart from the Central Committee and the Area Committees, were any other committees formed to deal with specific...
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. First of all, sanitation. We realised that we should have to keep the place clean. We had to clean it up, first of all, because it was in an awful mess, and then keep it clean. And so we had the sanitation committee with responsibility for that all the way through. We had the kitchen committees, so for food into the kitchens, the cooking, the serving, and all that sort of thing. Then we had, we knew we should need to attend to our children, because we had over 300 children with us of school age. And we had our education committee, which established, fortunately, we had the teaching staffs of the schools of the colony in. So we had an education committee to attend to all that. We had a health committee which established a hospital. We set aside a certain group of buildings for the camp hospital. We had the doctors and nurses from the hospitals in the colony in the camp with us. And in spite of acute shortages of drugs and medicines and equipment and that sort of thing, even though it was in Hong Kong and we knew where it was, the Japanese found great delight in refusing to let us have a lot of it. We only managed to prize it out of them as time went on, bit by bit. But the doctors and nurses did amazing work in that hospital, even to very tricky operations. And we established a clinic in each of the main areas so that we could nip things in the bud when trouble started. And great work was done there. Our entertainment committee did a wonderful job because, of course, we knew we should have to keep alive the will to live. And they found all sorts of unexpected talent in the camp, and our concerts, our plays, all that we had in that connection, were really particularly well done. And when the time came, as it did fairly early on, when all electricity was cut off, and we had to live entirely by the sun, and that meant for 5 months of the year, very long winter's nights, when, of course, depression can set in between, say, sundown and having to go to bed. Our entertainment committee got together a panel of speakers who were willing to speak and lecture on just about everything under the sun that they knew anything at all about. And they used to go out night by night in the pitch black and talk to people they couldn't see. But that's how we kept the spirits of people going.
Now, you've mentioned sanitation, health, kitchen committee, education committee, entertainments committee.
Entertainment committee.
Were there any others?
The church did a wonderful job in Stanley, and we had our ministers and clergy group. The only distinction we made was as between Protestant and Roman Catholic. We had a number of Roman Catholic priests in the camp, and they were a grand set of men. But we couldn't expect at that time for religious services to be so united that the Romans would come in with us, or even that we would go with them. But that was the only distinction. All non-Roman met together as the United Congregations of Stanley Camp. And I have a list somewhere of all the churches that were represented. It's quite astonishing. Mm-hmm. Anglican, of course, Methodist, Congregational, Brethren, various other odd communities. And, of course, the Americans, while they were there, they had an amazing collection of different types of churches. But we all formed one united Stanley congregation, and we worshipped together. We had Holy Communion together. Perhaps one of the best things that ever happened was that the Bishop of Hong Kong, who was a wonderful man in many ways, but a very difficult man in others, he was sent on leave, unknown at that time that there was going to be an attack on Hong Kong, and he was away in America. So he wasn't able to put his all into all this, as we were pretty sure he would have done had he been there. Mm. And so we had a very happy coming together. Mm. And so, in addition to our regular services, we had our study groups, we had our discussion groups going on. People were prepared for confirmation. Of course, as time went on, we had our marriages, we had our births as well as our deaths. And so people were married, children were baptized. And these were all ratified by a special act of Parliament later on, when the war was over.
Now, the subcommittees that you've mentioned below the central and the regional committees, the area committees, were they each elected or were some appointed?
Some member or members of the committee were allocated to each of these committees to head these committees up and to see to it that they did their work. That's how the thing worked. So they had their relationship with the Central Camp Committee all the time, and the camp committee with them. That's how the thing worked.
I see. So, in effect, the central committee appointed people to head each of the other committees.
That's right. That's right.
And then the heads of each of the other committees, they made further appointments to strengthen their particular groups.
As they felt they needed them, yes.
I see.
Yes.
Now, this is a very impressive description of organisation. How long did it actually take to achieve this?
We set up most of these committees in the very early days, but developed them and strengthened them as we found they needed to be, just as time went on. But by and large, after not too long a time, they sort of settled down and remained in being and did their work right through to the end.
After not too long, that means what, 3 months, 6 months?
Well, say 6 months at the outside. It was all sort of solidified within that time, some sooner than others.
And did the Japanese accept all of these arrangements?
The strange thing was, you see, we'd already started all this from that first temporary camp committee meeting, when they sent their officials into the camp and had their camp commandant and his staff. And when they saw what we had already done and what we were in process of doing, fortunately for us, they decided to let that carry on and to let that sort of thing be the government of the camp, with themselves as the main authority, and to step in whenever they wanted to, if they wanted to do something other than we were doing, or if they wanted to stop something that we were doing. But by and large, they gave us a rather wonderful freedom, and that is what made Stanley Camp the success which I claim it really was. Mm. Because with all the organisation that we did, and remembering that we had really to create something out of almost nothing, I think our organisation was so good and carried on so perfectly that our death roll was as low as it could be expected to be in such circumstances.
Was there anything at all that the Japanese changed or tried to change?
Not particularly. I think all that we were doing, it was practical, it was sensible, it was needed. You couldn't imagine anything else being anything better than it, and they just accepted it. They troubled us a fair bit by making themselves a darn nuisance from time to time to establish their authority and to show us we were still there. And as I say, they took great delight in refusing many of the requests that we made. But with patience, we discovered that if we gradually kept at it and it didn't upset them too much, a time would come when they would turn round and offer us the things that we had been asking for, and doing it as a sort of act of graciousness on their part, which was all right by us as long as we got the stuff that we needed.
You said last time we spoke that this first 6 months were hell, your words.
Yes.
In what sense was
well,
it hell?
I'm sure that was because the people were in a state of shock. You see, the attack on Hong Kong in the first place came as a great shock. The surrender came as another shock. The time in the hovels, the dives, another shock. How Stanley started, another shock. That was the sort of mental condition that they were in, and in a deteriorating physical condition too, and with a shocking uncertainty about the future. All this created an attitude and atmosphere and suspicion and a lot of dissension, and that was the sort of thing that we had to contend with during the first 6 months. Another factor, which I don't think we realized at the time, was this: that people were cut off completely, first of all, from all drink and from all smoking. And there were those among us who were bottle-a-day men. And there were smokers among us who, of course, were terrific smokers. To be cut off in one chop from all that had repercussions that we never realized could happen. And this made people discontented and restive. They didn't know what was happening to them, to themselves. They felt these things and didn't know why it was.
What about the disruption of family life, including the disruption of sexual life? Was that perhaps contributory to?
Undoubtedly. And of course, there was no answer to that, really. All that sort of thing had to find its own way of functioning in the circumstances as they were. And they did. But this took time. Fortunately, as an offset to the acute overcrowding in the rooms, where there was no privacy at all, except in these little armour rooms, of which there were very few, and in which myself and my wife happened to have one, by the grace of God, there was no privacy at all. So people had to find it in the open spaces in the camp. Now, one of the havens in the camp was the first cemetery which had ever been established in Hong Kong when the first landings were made at Stanley, when Hong Kong became a British possession. The first people there landed at Stanley and established the first cemetery there. And it was interesting to read the headstones because they all died of various fevers and within their 20s and 30s. And then that cemetery was closed for many years until we got there and we had to reopen it and use it for the burial of our own dead through all the internment years. But there were lovely trees there, there was privacy there, and that's where people used to go and find little corners for themselves, and that's how they got the privacy that they needed.
Did the repatriation of the Americans and the Canadians help the accommodation?
Undoubtedly, I would certainly go on to mention that. You see, there were just over 300 Americans, there was almost the same number of Canadians. And that gave us some good space to ease up where the worst cases were. And we knew where they were because we had it down on the nominal roll. And eventually we were able to persuade the Japanese authorities to play and to do that.
And another internee at Stanley who I've spoken to said that the Americans were actually very unpopular. Was that so in your opinion, and if so, why?
Some of them were. I think this was chiefly due to the man who was their leader, a man named Hunt. He was not one of what you call the nice Americans. There are very nice Americans, and we had them in the camp. But he was their head, and he gathered about him similar types. They were the only ones among us who seemed to have a lot of money. We had practically none. And they threw it about and got concessions through it, no doubt about that. And it was that created this sort of general attitude. With many of us, we had very good friends among the Americans who were there, and they with us. But it is true that there was that element.
We've talked about the organisation and management that the internees established for themselves. We haven't talked about the management, the Japanese management of the camp. Now, when they began to take more of an effective hand, what areas did they take unto themselves responsibility for?
Well, they made themselves responsible for the regular rations coming into the camp. They were the people to whom we had to go with requests for anything and everything that we felt we needed urgently and do our best to get certain quantities of these in. They were the ones who came in on that. We had morning and evening roll call every day that we were there to see to it that there'd be no escapes from the camp. One of the times when we had quite a disturbance was when it was reported that we had one too many, and they wondered where in the world he had come from. And after a lot of chasing and counting and what have you, we discovered that a baby had been born in the hospital overnight, and so the figures and the next morning figures were one adrift, one too many, and it took several hours to... we also had every week a visual count. When the internees were lined up outside their blocks with what were called their blockheads, every block had a representative. He was called a blockhead. For the most part, it was a courteous term. At times when they rowed with each other, it wasn't. And they called him a blockhead because they thought he was. Then the Japanese used to come round and count us. And those of us who were on the Camp Central Committee, a delegation of us, always had to go round with them. And they had to see to it that the count was actually as the figures we produced were. They'd seen everybody.
So I don't understand the difference between a visual count and the other one you were talking
well,
about.
Well, you could put what figures you liked in. If they weren't going to be seen and counted, somebody might have... Actually, in the early days, that happened. The only time there was a successful escape from the camp was in the very early days, before the Japanese had got the whole place surrounded with barbed wire and that sort of thing. And a number of people got away that particular night. Now, the figures that were sent in to the Japanese, both the night before when they were there, and then the next morning when they weren't there, and the day after that when they weren't there, they were the same figures, you see. And the Japanese only realized that something had happened when somebody, almost by chance, found that the figures weren't true. And so they needed to see every one of us at least once.